Hello, I'm Keith Kaplan, a software architect at Microsoft, and I'd like to welcome you to Behind the Code. In this series, we feature Microsoft employees who have achieved great things. Our goal is to reveal what it takes to create great software as we look at the technology and the person behind the code. Catherine Van Ingen is a software architect who describes herself as a Berkeley hippie. Her experience ranges from hardware work with the Alpha and MIPS processor teams to industrial-strength storage software for everything from logging data on particle accelerator experiments to information that is used to manage critical river dams. Catherine holds a doctorate in civil engineering from Caltech. Please welcome Catherine Van Ingen. You like the intro?
Yeah, sure.
We're glad you could be here, Catherine. And we've had some guests with some unusual backgrounds before, but I believe you're the first guest we've had with experience repossessing cars.
Yeah.
Is that true? How did you find yourself in that line of work?
Well, I was putting myself through college, and you've got to get a job. So what could I do? Well, I could collect bills. And I fell into it by chance and worked my way up through the organization over the 3 or 4 years that I was working there. From the person that called you every 30 days and said, send me the money, to the people that was doing skip tracing, finding people, and doing repos.
So the repo job is the top rung of the ladder there?
Yeah, pretty much. There was also tracing the mafia guy and going to this palatial house with these guys in Italian suits. That was pretty much the top of the ladder. Yeah, I decided that was far too dangerous a business, really. Software's a lot safer.
And another safer job that you had was you taught at Caltech for a while, right?
No, I didn't actually teach at Caltech. I was a grad student there. I taught at UC Berkeley.
Okay, excuse me. And how many other women were on the faculty there when you were doing that?
Zero.
Okay.
In the department.
And have you ever thought of returning to the teaching gig? Or?
You know, I have. Well, at some level, what I've ended up doing by going back and getting to work with academics in an academic setting, in fact, I'm working with an old friend of mine now from grad school, as well as Bev Law, who's in the audience, is at some level going back to the right part of teaching, the research part. I never considered myself a very good teacher. I was pretty lousy at it.
And so the good part of teaching is research. How does that?
Well, if you look at an academic job, you know, a professor's job is actually a very difficult job. You're really running your own business. It's very much like a small businessman because you have to fund everything. You have a turnover in employees, and you have, in theory, a mission that you're attempting to accomplish, your scientific vision. A very tough job. I don't think people actually understand just how hard it really is. Again, being in software is a much easier gig.
And I think one thing that you're working on now, it's called the Ameriflux project.
Yeah, we stumbled into a really terrific project. I had gone back to work with Jim Gray at his lab after, you know, being in Windows for a while. And we were kind of messing around with the usual sort of scalable storage, how to do big storage, how to do scalable storage. And the question really was what impact that was really going to have on the corporation. How are we paying back? And at the same time, Jim had started work with Alex Soleil at Johns Hopkins on the Sky server. And if you haven't seen it, check it out. It's really great visuals. And I realized he was onto something. And what he was onto was e-science. How do you bring computational science and a little bit of technology to bear on the sciences that are emerging as collaborations? If you think about science today, there's probably some continuum. We've got high energy physics on this hand, and I don't know, maybe field biology kind of at the smallest on this hand. And what that scale is sort of how big the data is and how well formed the collaboration is. High energy physics has petabytes of data, billions of objects. They've had large collaborations for, I don't know, 15 years at least, and have been growing collaborations for, boy, pretty much all my lifetime. Astronomers have shared instrumentation with shared telescopes. They're getting to be collaborations, biologists. And then there's kind of everybody else, the small scientists. And what Jim had actually done with the Sky Survey was bring a lot of technology to bear and organize the data handling. Because if you're a scientist, you're not spending a lot of your brain thinking about data and how to process data. You're thinking about what the science means, because that's what you should be thinking about. So kind of watching him, you realize that he's really on to something. There's something nice happening here because there's a lot of problems that are becoming important that really need a collaboration where traditionally there hasn't been a collaboration of people working. The internet helps this. You've got communication, right? You can share data in email, if nothing else. So
you can mail a petabyte attachment in email?
Well, you can't mail a petabyte attachment in email, but you can mail several gigabytes, it turns out, you know, by chopping it up and mailing. In fact, we did that recently, the hard way. There are freeware programs to chop things up and freeware programs to put things back together. So, and most data isn't actually a petabyte. The data we've been dealing with in Ameriflux is in the several gigabyte range. So it's small. It fits on your laptop. You don't really want to use it too much on your laptop, but you can certainly carry it on your laptop. So by chance, we got involved with the folks at the Berkeley Water Center looking at hydrology, and that led us to Dennis Baldacci and to Bev, who are really revolutionizing the way that global warming and carbon climate is being done. You know, I'm not really a scientist, don't really understand it, but naively, if you think about global warming, everybody understands that there's a lot of carbon being up, you know, we're burning fossil fuels and stuff. The question is, where does it go? And it can stay in the atmosphere, it can fall into the ocean, or it could get absorbed by plants and interact. And what's not really well understood, as far as I know, is that plant interaction. So there's a community of, oh, gosh, it looked like 100, maybe 200 scientists around the world trying to get their hands around how does CO2 interact with plants? You know, what role is that in global warming? And it's really pretty exciting because they're individual scientists with individual instrumentation all learning how to contribute data to a common data set and then do common analysis. So we're exactly at the right time to put a little bit of technology, a little bit of database technology, a little bit of MATLAB, a little bit of Excel even, and make some important science pop out.
There's enough data gathered that it's a problem.
There's 600 site years sitting there ready to go. It's so exciting.
It seems like, though, when you talk about these subjects of global warming and are humans causing it, is there political pressure? Is there someone kind of leaning on you, say, go do this experiment, but make sure we find this answer at the end?
You know what's great is I work for Microsoft. And I can't tell you how lucky that is, right? Because you wander in, and there's no other agenda other than, does our technology make any sense here? Right? You know, maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. What does it mean for our technology to help doing this kind of data processing? So that, you know, I can kind of ignore some part of the politics,
and really,
which is a good thing.
But what is in it for Microsoft? Why is Microsoft sending you to do this?
Well, I'm lucky. Seriously, I think there are several things in it for Microsoft. First, the technical community, computing community, is a community that hasn't seen Microsoft for a long time. And it's an interesting community. I mean, I came up in that community. They do interesting thing with computers, so part visualization, part data processing, and then the kind of, you know, large-scale computing that we're so familiar with. The second thing is that we learn things about trying to use our products in those environments. If you'd asked me 2 years ago, you know, have you ever built a data cube and used SQL analysis services? I would have laughed and laughed and laughed and said, what's that?
Well, I'll ask you that. What is that? What is a data cube?
Well, funny you should ask that. It turns out that SQL actually comes with a number of services alongside it. We all know relational databases. I do now. One of which is an OLAP database. Basically, the idea is you suck data out of the database and organize it along, if it was only three dimensions, a cube. It's really an n-dimensional cube, figure any dimensions. But for simplicity, let's talk about space, time, and measurement type, and then various attributes of data, averages, minimum, maximum, standard deviation. What the data cube allows you to do is slice and dice that very, very efficiently. You could do that in a SQL database, but you'd have to write a lot of code and the queries get expensive, blah, 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 blah. Whereas an artifact of structuring things in a data cube and using that technology, you pay that once, you pay that during the cube build, and then you just browse the cube, including using Excel.
So the cube is an in-memory representation, it's not an on-disk store like a database?
It is actually an on-disk store, but it acts in the same way that SQL Server does, that you hold whatever you can in memory.
All right.
A different database organization with a different query language.
And I know you're also working on some river management related to the Russian River?
Yeah, the Russian River.
Which feeds some of the wineries in Northern California.
Well, when we started with the Berkeley Water Center, since I was investigating how the technology could be used for this class of problem, I really wanted to do two projects, because if you do one, it's really, really easy to make it custom software and kind of go off. And by doing two that were similar but different, right? In one case, you've got the global climate stuff. In the other case, you've got traditional hydrology, something I actually knew a little bit about.
Traditional hydrology? Of us aren't in fact, trained civil
rain
engineers.
Rain comes out of the air. You know, rain comes out of the air, hits the ground. Where does it go? Hey, some of it goes in the channel, some of it grows in the groundwater. People dig wells, they suck water out of the groundwater. Sooner or later, something hits the bay. Is that a good thing? Well, it depends. It turns out for the Russian River, and this is part of the exciting thing, where water engineering has changed in my life, is it used to be all about water levels. You know, was there enough water at Healdsburg? Well, okay. It's no longer that. It now is about actually coho salmon. It turns out coho salmon spawn on the Russian River, and they're on the endangered species list. One of the things that means that instead of the Sonoma County folks being able to effectively run their own show, the United States government come in and insist that the water and the river is managed in a certain specific way, including replacing a natural river with a concrete channel at the discretion of the government. So there's a real question about how to manage the natural channel, given increasing urbanization, increasing agriculture in the area, well enough to ensure that the salmon can continue. So it's not about water quantity per se, but it's also about things like water temperature and quality.
So it's not just that the vineyards have enough water for the grapes and enough water for their sinks, but salmon care what temperature the water is,
too? The salmon absolutely care what temperature. So one of the things that happens is that you end up, you know, outside technology, one of the challenges there is to retrain the guys that actually maintain the channel. I mean, this is a guy in a pickup truck, right, that goes out with a chainsaw, and he's, you know, chainsawing the trees that are in the middle of the channel because natural channels aren't always full of water and trees grow. And it turns out that there are two kinds of willows. There's willows that have a stalk and then grow out, and willows that basically are bushes. Well, one is a great idea if you want to make cooler water because it's adding shade. The other is basically just a friction factor waiting to happen. So teaching the guys in the chainsaws which willow to whack at what time was part of the conservation.
So don't cut the fluffy ones.
Don't cut the fluffy ones, you know.
And SQL Server told you the answer to all this.
No, the SQL Server had nothing to do with it. But it's part of the learning that it takes, right, you know, in order to do this sort of stuff. It's why working on these projects is so fascinating, right, because there's all this other stuff going on. Guys in trucks.
So sometimes it's a big
with power tools.
Power tools are always fun. I'd like to go back quite a bit in time here to there was a time when you worked at a few different particle accelerators, I think at Fermilab and also at Stanford?
Yeah, I worked at Slack as well.
And what were you doing there?
What was I doing there? Well,
and how long ago was this also?
It was the early 80s. I was teaching at Berkeley, and there was kind of this ongoing kind of question in my mind. Did I really care about the science, or do I care about the toys? Okay? The hardware, the software, the toys. And I came to the conclusion that teaching was good. You know, I was okay at it. Getting everything funded, I was kind of okay at that. But I missed the toys. I had fallen in with a bad crowd. Okay? Really bad crowd.
And so to you, a toy is a cool server, so...
A toy's of 70,000 channels coming in at a kilohertz, in 82, which these days would be equivalent to a good petabyte or so coming in at order of magnitude faster, you know, end plates of a detector that they got somebody who lifts nuclear weapons and nuclear vessels into tip, so, you know, 200 tons of steel. Those are toys.
So back me up. So what... Give us, I mean, you did give us the 60-second summary of hydrology. Let's hear the 60-second summary of what's an end plate and what's going on in a particle accelerator. Where's all this data coming from?
Well, so the 60-second, the kind of naive, no science kind of approach is the following. There's an accelerator ring, and there's basically two hoses of water coming in at weather. Splash, okay? And the detector exists for one reason, to catch the splash. Okay, and a detector really is a collection of subsystems, usually made of fairly exotic materials, beryllium, things that are corrosive, things that explode. You know, it's great. And The goal really is to capture enough of the splash often enough, sample it often enough to get the very rare splashes, to discover the new particles. That's kind of the physics I understand. So, I mean, you know, sorry about that.
So, in logging the data, I mean, is that the problem that you can't just say, well, we'll catch 90% of the data, because what you're really looking for is that in a million?
You're catching. You're doing zero channel suppression in the detector. You're catching between the online trigger and the offline trigger. You're catching, which is basically what we would call grid computing today. You're actually recording about 1 in 1,000 events. All right. In fact, 1 in 10,000. So it's extremely important to understand what you're filtering on. And you are taking more data than really you can afford to analyze effectively. I worked at CDF in the early 80s. There are still students finishing their degrees based on data from that experiment. Okay, that detector ran for 10 years. These things are very, very large and very, very long running. From a straight up toys perspective, we had one of the first VAX clusters, you know, in the universe. A brand new high-speed electronic network. This is kind of in the early days of Ethernet, but if you really want to take data real fast, you need something far more parallel. It's got grid computing, you know, early on. So it's got all of those sort of distributed system aspects going. That's a great environment to work in.
And you later worked at DEC doing, I believe it was something storage related there as well, right?
Well, I kind of went to DEC because I had been in high energy physics for 4 years, and I could kind of see that, you know, the next generation of detectors are going to be 20 years long, and they're going to be a petabyte, and it's going to be kind of the same thing again. And I also decided that, you know, I was doing computing professionally, sort of, right? And maybe it was time to go work for a company and really learn how to do this stuff right. And DEC was the obvious company to work for in those days. So I went to work for them in the real-time group, because that's how I could get hired. But I got drifted into the high-end computing group very early on and got sent off to the Strategic Storage Task Force more by luck. I was kind of senior enough that I wouldn't embarrass everybody and junior enough that nobody would yell at me. You know, it was kind of, so I was the pretty face. And what an education, right? Because you luck into being on this task force at exactly the right time in history. Because we have a really big disk. I mean, disk used to be, you know, enormous kind of washing machine things. Mm-hmm. And we had a big disk project out in Colorado that was going. And it was exactly at the innovator's dilemma time where big disks no longer made economic sense. They were great technical things, but it just didn't make any sense. These little tiny SCSI. That says it all, SCSI things.
You were supposed to pronounce it sexy, you know.
They were SCSI. Right. I spelled it with 2 Z's. We're clearly positioned as the right choice, right? I mean, we were going to have to figure out how to make them robust because they were kind of SCSI, but it was clearly the right choice, right? And being able to be part of the decision process to cancel a big disk project and effectively get out of the disk business and into the subsystem business was, you know, once in a lifetime kind of opportunity, as well as you just learn everything about storage all at once, right? Because you're hanging around with everybody in the corporation that knows storage, right? We were looking at backup. There was a plan to do physical backup to tape. That's a really dumb idea. Backup is fast. Restore is horrible, okay? But you walk through all the system aspects as part of the discussion about does this make sense, doesn't it make sense, and you figure out a way, kind of intelligent way, of speeding up the then existing file-oriented backup. So it was a terrific education. It was like going to grad school in storage.
And you got to work at DEC at the time that there were some other just real legends there, Gordon Bell, Jim Gray. I mean, did you get to work with some of these guys?
And well,
were they already legends then?
Gordon had just left, but, you know, and Kuttler had just left. Kuttler was there, had gone to Microsoft about 6 months after I joined DEC. So, you know, I missed Rob Short by this much. But there were a number of other legends. Bill Lang was there. Bill Lang, Ben Thomas, Rich Wittick, the architect of Alpha. You know, just people that have gone to become legends in the computing business. Richie Larry. Right, it was on the same task force. Gordon I met when I came to interview with Jim Gray. Now, I met Jim Gray on the son of IO Task Force. There was an annual IO Task Force. The IO is coming. We're not ready. Make a task force. And, you know, different problems each year. I met Jeff West on one of those. Jeff East, excuse me. Sorry about that. Met Peter Spiro on one of those.
So you've sort of gone down the names of the SQL Server team at this point, yes.
I think I met Hal Berenson.
Okay.
You know, one of those. So it was one of these places where if you hung out long enough, you'd meet everybody. You know, just sit in one place, watch the committees go, you meet everybody. And there was one task force in particular. We all trooped out to meet this brand new hire who was supposed to be this, you know, database god. And I walked in the room, and this tall, bearded guy throws a quarter on the table and says, "That's a disk. Deal with it." And that was my introduction to Jim Gray.
Always with the strange visual elements. Because when he was on this show, he had the smoking hairy golf ball prop. And
well, you know, it was. I think it was the late 80s, probably 88. You'll have to look it on the web. IBM actually made a disk that was a true rotating disk, and it fit in a flashcard form factor. Mm-hmm. So that would have
the
been
microdrive.
Jim's quarter disk, yeah.
And that was the point of the lesson, was what size a disk could be?
Well, it did get you thinking.
I know. You worked briefly at SGI, and
yeah.
Then a place called Open Market.
Well, DEC was a tricky place to work because DEC got very sad, and after a while, putting my head on the table, clunk, clunk, beating it, I decided it was time to go get a new job. A bunch of us went to SGI, the processor team, kind of, and I. Hey, I'm with processor guys. That's cool. I'll go with you. Got to SGI, realized that was a company that was headed for the same trouble. You know, Mike, it's 1988 here. This is scary. I decided to do a startup because you were down in the valley and it was the right thing to do, and commerce on the internet was going to be the thing. So
I'm not sure that's going to catch on.
I don't know. You know, that commerce on the internet thing. You know, let's see. What am I wearing that I didn't buy on the internet?
Well, you know, told us already you made the vest. So.
Yeah, but I bought the yarn on the internet.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, I mean, it's tough.
But you were going to Open Market, though. This was before, sort of before buying everything on the internet was fashionable.
Well, one of the guys that I knew from DEC Research called me and said, why don't you do this startup? And I said, are you nuts? I don't do startups. What do I know? You know, he said, this is commerce on the internet. It's going to be great. And I thought about it, and I went back and I talked to them, and I figured, well, you know, why not? Why not do a startup? Because they had a wonderful customer base. It turned out all the customer bases were all those early adopters who were attempting to do commerce on the internet. Time Warner, Disney, Bertelsmann, right? So it's that high-end customer that I like, toys, and, you know, a very complex application when you really think about it end-to-end. So I had a great time. I learned an awful lot.
Yet you didn't stay there for long because...
Well, you do. Startups are kind of funny. For starters, I didn't want to move back to Boston, and it was a Boston-based company. But you kind of, you know, I stayed there long enough to do the kind of first ship kind of thing, and then I decided that, you know, it's time to go and get another job. So I was knocking around the valley, and I called Jim Gray. Because I knew Jim, and Jim knew everybody. And I thought, well, if there's a hot project, Jim will know.
And by this point, it's around, what, 96 or so?
96.
So Jim is at Microsoft now.
I didn't even know where Jim was. First of all, I had to track him down. And sure enough, he's in San Francisco, because, of course, he was going to be in San Francisco. And I called him and said, look, I'm going to take you to lunch, and you're going to tell me about a great project for me to go work on. Okay. And during lunch, he says, why don't you come work for me? And I said, Jim, there's only two things wrong with that. One, you work for this, you know, PC weenie company, and I do big system server stuff. Well, that's kind of a problem. And two, you're a researcher, and I don't know nothing about computer science research. And he made both of those go away very, very cleverly. You know, he pretty much rigged my interview loop, so it was full of server guys. And, you know, people either knew or people that had been at IBM or something like that. So I sort of couldn't sort of say that. He made the final pitch. He said, suppose it doesn't work out. He says, it's only a BART ride. You can go get another job. And I thought, well, that's a pretty good argument. So I started working at Microsoft.
Now, how did he talk you into the research part?
Well, he just sort of said, if it doesn't work out, you know, you'll go get another job. And I thought about that. And he was right. And I figured, well, meanwhile, you know, I'd met Gordon and I talked to Gordon. And I realized that with Jim and Gordon in one office, there was going to be a lot of traffic and a lot of stuff going on. So if it didn't work out, there was going to be a project there that I would see to go work on, right? There was no downside. Suppose I could become a researcher. Hey, who knew?
And when you got here, came up to Redmond to Windows, and that was certainly when I met you, there were some technologies that you then came to own. They had been outsourced
to
several different vendors.
Partnered.
Tell us, how did some of these things go, and what should we learn from this?
Wow. You know, it's interesting because on Windows 2000, the following storage management components, all of the storage management components, were partnered with various different partners. There is, let's see if I can remember them all, remote storage management, removable storage management, remote storage services, the defrag, the volume management, backup.
That was all I was going to be able to name.
I think that's all. And they were all done with partners. And the good news, bad news is, in thinking about it, I'm not sure that we as Microsoft would have been able to build any of them. Not because we didn't have good engineering, but to understand what to build across that collection, you actually have to understand something about server storage. And there wasn't a lot of server storage people in the Windows group at that time, right? There was like Kevin and Felipe and me. And understanding, first of all, what to build, and understanding then really rethinking and understanding not what IBM built, but what we should build, is a really tough problem. So doing the partnering is a good thing from that standpoint. We got to learn, you know, what is this storage management stuff? The second reason the partnering is good, and this is arguably, you know, again, something that's tough for engineers to live with, it's really important for Microsoft not to do it all. When you start talking about storage management, there's a lot of high-end functionality that's really high touch. It's hard. It's always going to be hard. You really want that IBM guy sitting next to you to take the fall when something goes.
So by high touch, you mean the sort of consulting that's expected to
exactly.
come with?
Exactly. You know, these are very complex systems. You know, and they're very high dollar value systems. The data value, they're important, right? So us being in that business, there's a real problem there. Having somebody to do that extra last little bit of sit with the customer, explain to the customer, make sure the customer doesn't color outside the lines is really important. Even if the customer's experience on the Unix platform, you know, or the IBM platform, our platform is just enough different that having someone help do that bridge is really important. And that's not us, right? And it certainly wasn't us in the Windows 2000 timeframe. So the whole idea was actually good for us, good for the customer, and good for the partners because they could have this add-on market, right? So it sounds good. So that's the good part of the story. The not-so-good part of the story is executing together, we didn't really know how to do. One of the kind of phrases at DEC that used to talk about partnering is really relevant. And it would talk about going out on a date and then showing up at the church expecting to get married the next day and wondering where the bride or groom is, right? Well, you forgot to ask, you know. Mm-hmm. And that was a classic sort of lack of communication that would happen when you partnered. It was classic across the board. When I inherited all of that stuff.
Well, it seems like you're going to have even more of that. You know, when one way I would think to avoid that is, well, let's have a really rigid spec. We're going to job this out, but we'll tell them what
we
want.
Boy, we're so good at that.
Well, but you're saying, though, that part of what the partner might bring to the table is knowing what to ask for in spaces where maybe we wouldn't have even known.
It should have been. You know, one of the nicest examples is probably the remote storage services. We ran a dog food server. For years. The idea of that is that it's tape hierarchical storage, right? Good news, bad news was a great idea. It's an idea that's been around the industry for, I don't know, 20 years. It's an idea whose time to tape has never come and never will because of the following sorts of experience. We'd been running a dog food server for, I think it was a couple years. And, you know, the server had gotten old and it was time to actually migrate. So there was this sort of decision that, well, you know, we really ought to replace it. And at the same time, we lost a disk. Now, it was called Scratch Scratch, and it was supposed to be for temp file only. And during the next week or so, I got more mail from more people saying, "What happened to my file? I'm panicked," than I like to admit. Trying to actually restore that server really did take us over a week. It should never take that long. Why? Because some of the files are on tape and some of the files are on disk. And we never actually kind of dug down on the testing and we never actually spec the algorithm by which this deep recovery was going to be done. Because it didn't occur to us that once you'd been running a system like this, you might want to stop. And of course, if you're the vendor, once you've been running a system like this, you don't want the customer to stop. So, you know, the core of the idea is that we've been, think about tape as a sequential medium. You've been migrating files for 2 years. So the oldest files are over here and the youngest old files are over here. There may be some intermediate copies because that slide deck that you left around for a year and then suddenly went back to has got two or three copies. If you sorted that mess so that you read each tape exactly once, you might have a good recovery experience. Well, that's not the way the product worked.
There was random seeking in tape,
and there's few things uglier than random seeking in tape, especially when the tape's old and probably hasn't been read in, I don't know, 6 months and suddenly doesn't really want to read anymore.
And there's more than one tape involved also, right?
Oh, yeah.
So it's not even like you set the one tape and you leave for the night, so... And some of these things we did eventually, they were re-implemented sort of in-house. Is that a testament to the fact that outsourcing them was a bad idea, or we outsourced it badly, or...?
No, I don't think so. You know, a number of those things, I mean, defrag's an example of something that we changed the algorithm to improve the performance. I don't think outsourcing, you know, that's a perfectly reasonable thing to do. We improve our performance all the time. We make changes to make things fit better in our system all the time. I don't really think that that's an indication that there's something fundamentally wrong.
It just seems like going forward there will be so much more outsourcing, probably just that's the nature of the industry. Is there a lesson, though, that you'd like to share with us? And, you know, Catherine's tips on how to outsource a software project.
Boy, Catherine's tips on how to... That's scary. First of all, don't listen to Catherine. Yeah, I think so. One is you do want to really spec things, right? Second is the relationship. I think it's really important that you establish an engineer-to-engineer relationship early on and you maintain that. Because no matter how good that spec is, there will be things like that come up like that. Gee, you know, if we implemented a sort. And being able to communicate cleanly, crisply, right? Making sure that the outsourced partner has training. One of the things we're noticing in the e-science that's relevant as well is something we've started to call the everybody knows factor. Everybody knows, fill in the blank. You know, everybody knows we field interrupts at such and such. Everybody knows you use this header. Everybody doesn't know, right? And the bigger the collaboration, the more often it is that they don't know.
Or that someone at least doesn't know.
Someone, well, if they're outside, you know, one of the things you find in collaborations is the everybody knows Fred doesn't take data well. You know, everybody knows Fred really can't, so we put him in charge of measuring the temperature in the studio, right, where it doesn't really matter.
No offense, Fred.
You know, that everybody knows factor is something you have to be aware of and really work really hard. And I think that's probably the biggest thing. The relationship is probably more important than anything else.
And one thing that we did later implement in-house was something called VDS. There's the volume disk service. Am I spelling that out right? And what was that? What did it,
well, that's
what
the,
it do?
That's the volume management API that Norbert and I started. Teo joined us in implementing it. what a great team. You got all the great guys at the right place to build something. We built a pair of services for Whistler, the volume snapshot service and the volume back disk service. The goal really was to put a real platform service, you know, something that partners could build on. In the case of VSS, it's a, both a back, it's a floor wax and a breath mint. It's both a backup infrastructure as well as a clean mechanism for previous versions, right? The Vista and Windows 2003 previous version snapshot service is really manufactured by that. With VDS, our goal was to provide a clean API so that people could manage both hardware and software RAID. We saw PCI RAID becoming more and more important. And at the time we started, the expected value for how you would set up a PCI RAID was going to the BIOS. You know, not my favorite answer at any time. It's changed somewhat. What you have now today is sort of the balkanization. Every card you get has yet another little GUI application, yet another service. We were seeing that with high-end hardware RAID. With really high-end hardware RAID, what was happening is everybody had their own API, and you really couldn't even mix and match. That's gotten a lot better as well. So having one place where you just were guaranteed, given that at the time there was no standard, you could have an API, you could create your RAID set, you could create the snapshot, and that we would implement with any standard that arrived, right? If there has been now a SNIA standard coming up for hardware RAID management, we can make calls underneath that, right? So for folks like SQL or folks like Exchange, if they want to know about the storage underneath them, they can use the platform API.
Now, we've heard that there was some bit of controversy around the time that you were checking all this code in, this VDS code in particular, and Ian McDonald was kind of the gatekeeper of what did and didn't get checked in at the time. And we actually talked to him, and this is what he had to say about it.
In previous releases of Windows, we'd had some technology that was basically sort of the thing to be able to back up your system that was all part of a deal that had sort of gone south. And technically, I don't think anybody particularly liked what was in the system. So Catherine made up VDS, which now has created this whole industry around it, and there are big companies who are selling products based off the technology that was put in Windows Server 2003, you know, VDS. And you know, I think that at the time she was trying to be sneaky about putting some of the things in, whether it was because of the deal was horrible or just because she's naturally sneaky and wants to find different ways of being able to bend the rules to be able to get more features in. And so we would have open discussions around her putting the features in, and usually an open discussion with Catherine involves her sneaking up beside you very quietly and yelling.
Now certainly that's a judgment call that a lot of people have to make, though. There's someone making rules, someone saying what should and shouldn't be checked in, and yet we all have our pet features. How do you make that judgment call there?
Well, in my defense, both VSS and VDS, and it's VSS that's the really important one in the industry, went in Whistler. Whistler was a 3-month dev cycle, as we all know. And we kind of had this choice of we could stop work at the end of 3 months and then wait the, how long was it, until it finally shipped, or we could continue to execute working very closely with tests and very close with PM so that at any given time when we did a check-in, it was safe, right? It was ready to ship. And we chose to do the latter, frankly, with the idea that since we were primarily dealing with user mode code, since we were dealing with code that, again, primarily was not used day in and day out by customers, but rather by backup applications or configuration applications, that it was relatively low risk. It wasn't like changing the file system, okay? Now Ian saying yelling is kind of interesting.
Because he's a quiet guy himself.
Because he's a quiet guy himself,
and
after all.
He probably hurt his sensitive psyche.
Yeah, and it is true that for every DCR we did, we probably checked in two. So
you got permission for one and checked in.
Yeah, we actually got caught by the cluster guys at one point. I had to write a DCR after we'd done the check-in 3 months later because people were complaining. Would I do it again in Windows? No, probably not. Windows was a different organization in those days. I still would continue to execute, right, and playing kind of schedule chicken because it was the right thing to do. There was a window of time in which we could do both of those services and get them out in Windows Server 2003 and get the infrastructure put in XP, because XP has VSS, and move the industry forward. Or we could walk away and let the existing sort of storage management be this balkanized stuff from this vendor, and just, say, hey, we don't really understand storage. We're just these guys, And I think we made the right choice.
There's one other rumor also that you were sort of selling this feature to other groups before you actually had permission to check it in.
Not me. That wasn't me. That was Steve Olson.
I see. Interesting.
Consummate PM.
Well, I'm not going to name names, but there's someone who told us that it was you actually doing that. But we'll hear from Steve in a little bit, though. And trust me, his version of the story is slightly different than yours. But now, I know you also were managing a team remotely that was in the India Development Center.
I worked with folks in India as well. Yeah.
And what is that like? It's you were talking about keeping the close relationship among the engineers, and yet you've got many time zones apart here.
Well, we did two things. I think it probably is a result of the experience I had partnering. We started regular video conferencing, and that makes a great bit of difference. When you're talking to somebody in India, the phone delay makes it really easy to talk over somebody. And when you talk over somebody, inevitably the person you talk over thinks you're stupid, you're lying, it's a negative response, okay? So having that video feedback, being able to wave, make faces, show things, was terrifically important. The other thing I did is, frankly, I went there a lot. And got to know the guys, had pictures taken, went out to dinner, just, made sure that there was face contact.
And that seems, you mentioned going there a lot, because when you were working up here in Redmond, you never really lived here, right? You've always done the come and visit us so often we think you're here, but...
There's really two of me.
Really?
It's the only way.
I see. There's a Clark Kent Superman phenomenon going on here. But really...
Evil twin.
Do you think that helps you, though, the fact that you tend to be the remote person so often?
Well, it's made me more sensitive to what it means to be a remote person. Being down in San Francisco and being, on the phone at a meeting here in Redmond, you get used to what it takes to really join the meeting. Right? And I think it's made me more sensitive when I'm sitting in a conference room.
And we mentioned the difference. You were talking about working in research and how it was hard to talk you into it. You've done the sort of product team jobs up here in Redmond, and then also more research-like work. Is it a reason why you've settled on the research side, though? Or are you completely over that fear you had of being a researcher?
No, I'm not over the fear. I think what's happened to make me very comfortable doing what I'm doing now is that it's kind of between classic computer science research and product. Right. What you're doing in many respects is prototyping applications and then finding ownership groups long term. So I think of it more as AD, right, in which you're between the product group sort of saying, it would have been a lot easier if you'd done this, or have you thought about doing this? We had a meeting last week with the Office guys, and Office has some really terrific stuff in it for helping the technical market. You can actually edit equations in Word, without crashing. My personal favorite, Excel, has some really nice integration with pivot tables and stuff like that. So, being able to kind of feed that back and hear and create that sort of virtual cycle is really nice. At the same time, I'm not really trying to be a scientific researcher. I'm their midwife.
You're the proxy to the data people, or?
Yeah. I've done a lot of data handling, right? I've moved a fair amount of data in my life, and moving a little more is a good thing.
And are you in the course of this work, are you finding yourself wanting to go back and talk to your volume management friends and say, boy, we really messed this up. It turns out this doesn't work as well as I'd hoped. In a sense, you're having to be your own customer now.
In terms of the Windows storage stuff, I haven't found anything that I would really change, right, to be honest with you. I mean, we were lucky in the first kind of set of partners and features. We tuned that, you know, remote storage is no longer in the product. It didn't make any sense. You've done something nice with disk-to-disk migration, right? We've effectively learned how to do that stuff. And my focus these days is much more in the application realm. And I think it's because I perceive that as where the action is these days, right? You know, operating systems are interesting, databases are interesting, but apps are where the action is. And actually, it's also where the leverage is in terms of really helping people, right, change. I mean, when I started in the computer biz, computer people were these, like, you use computers, are you nuts? The data that I took for my PhD was the first data in that lab that had ever been taken straight digitally. Okay, I took more data than anybody else in the field combined because I was taking data at a rapid rate, and I took it pure digitally. It started digital, it ended digital. Right? Everybody else had either done it with a pad and paper or with an analog tape. It was then converted.
Which effectively limits how much data you can take anyway.
Well, and guarantees you. And I couldn't use that approach for the problem I was working on. I was working on two-phase flow. You couldn't really do it. So.
Well, I promised you that we would come back and we would hear what Steve Olson had to say about the early days of getting VDS and VSS checked in, and here it is.
So we were in a meeting and we were talking about VSS, which is the Volume Shadow Copy Service, and we were with some participants from another company who were discussing the approach, and one of the participants was less than convinced that this feature could actually be put in a product and was telling the stories about he'd seen lots of Microsoft products before come and go, and he didn't believe that this was really going to make it into the product. And Catherine, in a very reserved way, but you could tell she was really mad, said to him that he better just watch and see, and if their company didn't want to get on board and work with us on this, that's fine. But this would be in the product. And Catherine had a way of driving things and getting things done, of doing what it took to get things done, whether that was within the system or outside the system. If she made her mind up that things had to be done, they did get done.
It's funny, you know, Ian mentioned the thing about the sneaky. Steve Olson mentions this, whether it's inside or outside the system. We don't even prompt the people to say these things. Everyone seems to have this impression of you.
Well, now, to be fair, that particular meeting, Steve had talked to his counterpart at that particular company, and it was totally staged. Steve kind of expected me to erupt halfway through the meeting. And he was counting on the fact that I would.
And so he was supposed to, you know, there's some little special signal and you were supposed to be wrapped at
that
point.
Yeah, yeah, it was a dog whistle, you know, six.
I see. But Steve, more flatteringly though, he did say that you do have a very good ability to simplify things, and certainly everyone wants things to be as simple as they can be. How do you make that call though between so simple it's useless and just right?
Man, that's, you know, it's tough, and it's one of those things that I think for me at least, I'm constantly evaluating, constantly learning. One of the hardest parts for me in coming to Microsoft as someone who had been, you know, kind of a high-end kind of system server guy was rethinking everything I knew for Microsoft, right? There wasn't going to be a service business. It had to be simple. It had to be automated. You had to make the right defaults. It had to work most of the time, okay? Classic example. We were talking about the volume manager earlier. One of the longest real questions that we had was, in the event that you've had a fault-tolerant volume that's lost a member and the members come back, okay, do you bring the volume online automatically or not? Well, if you're a Unix guy or an IBM guy, the answer is no, of course you don't, because there's a risk that the volume has been corrupted. You have to be very careful. You want to know exactly. You as the system manager, you want to be able to gate that. Well, as an NT guy, you say, well, geez, that's wrong. I want my data, you know, and I'll work it later.
And 99% of it's probably
perfectly
valid.
You know, 99.9% of the time, it's perfectly fine, right? That the file system's going to go through check. It'll be fine. So there you have two different opinions, both valid for the right market, and you have to kind of weigh them apart and decide, right? And that's the challenge of doing software at Microsoft for me, is finding that balance and constantly looking at it. You listen to customers, you watch people, right? If you can't explain it to, you know, an average customer, it's way too hard.
Moving outside the software realm, I know that for fun you certainly enjoy travel. Where's your next vacation plan to?
Well, at the end of the last vacation, which was around Southeast Asia for 2 months, where I hit most of the major ruins, Bagan in Burma, Angkor Wat, various smaller temples in Vietnam, and then Borobudur in Indonesia, I decided that it was time to see the other big structures that are part of the Americas. So I'm thinking the Mayan ruins down in Guatemala and Mexico.
You have certainly arranged your life and your career around getting to stay in the Bay Area. Why is that? What's your attraction?
You know, I came to Berkeley in, when was it? 1970, spring of 1970. And it was my natural habitat. There's something about it I've always liked, and I've ended up moving in and out of it three times. When we moved back the last time, you know, I kind of said, well, you know, this is dumb. Why move out when I'm only going to move back?
How do you balance work and life?
I don't.
Well, you certainly seem to have a good time.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you're not having fun, what's the point? You know, I don't think I'm particularly good at that. I mean, people ask that a lot. And I always try to have fun at work and make sure that I'm having fun that doesn't involve work. Because, you know, you only get to do this once. If you're not having fun, what's the point? Besides, I also find that doing things outside of work, I mean, I actually enjoy cooking, okay? I had dinner with 12 people at my house last week. And there's something about that I'll be thinking about technical things while I'm doing something else. And that break from work actually makes me more productive.
Catherine, we have a few questions that we ask all of our guests. And the first one is, what advice would you have for someone in this field?
I almost always tell somebody to go talk to somebody else. I can usually find just the right person. For example, I used to tell people to go talk to Jim because he always said something much smarter than I could ever do. These days, I usually, you know, if it's a younger person that hasn't actually entered computer science, I almost tell them to go get a degree something other than computer science. You can lose computer science afterwards. Learning English, learning physics, learning biology gives you something else to round out your life.
How would you describe your work to someone who is not technical?
I started long ago. I was at a party in Pasadena, and there was this guy who I knew was a theoretical physicist. And when he introduced himself, people weren't taking four steps back. So I figured out what he was doing, and I've always done the same thing. It goes like this. I go to work in the morning. I have some coffee. I read email. I talk on the phone. I write stuff on the whiteboard. I occasionally write stuff on paper. I go to lunch. That's important. I meet with other people. I write some more stuff. I usually wipe off the blackboard. And I go home. And that's what I do.
In life, what would you compare to producing software?
Definitely working in a restaurant, without a doubt. It's got that same adrenaline rush. It's got the same attention to the detail. And it, like software, is a journeyman problem, really learning the job on the job.
You know you're a computer nerd when?
Boy. You know you're a computer nerd when in preparation for answering that question, you go to your favorite search engine, look for yourself using old mail addresses, and find a computer nerd test.
How did you do?
And you proceed to take it, which I did. Trying to, you know, this is an old one, so it's kind of tricky. I actually passed.
Good.
I'm still a nerd.
Congratulations. We'd also like you to draw your favorite data structure and explain it to us.
Now, this is a hard question because a lot of the really good ones have been used. You know, you're going to have to find a new question for the terminal one. I went back to the structure that was really part of my first patent, the first time I went through the patent experience at DEC. We were in a problem where we were building high-end I.O. adapters, and it was getting harder and harder to build them because we were losing it all in overhead. So we redesigned the data structures that are used between the software driver and the adapter or storage subsystem firmware. And it's called the N-port queues. What they really are a pair of linked lists, but with a twist. Let me kind of turn around here. Simple linked list. Here's the twist. So the driver puts commands on this queue. The adapter puts commands on this queue. So you're recycling queue elements, okay? Why not use a ring? Well, ring buffers are quite commonly used. They're basically arrays. Storage adapters in particular want to complete things out of order. Rings have the problem that they want to stay in order. So you take the ring off. Each of the elements contains a pointer to the real payload. Okay. The trick with it is the very last element on the queue is invalid at all times. It doesn't have any payload. What happens is, in order to insert something on the queue, all you have to do is put another invalid element here and make this one valid. One of the things that means is you're, from a point of view of the hardware, you're doing the minimum possible DMAs, updates, etc., in order to requeue. It's very, very efficient. The other little trick with it, of course, is that the addresses can pass in pairs. Virtual address here for the convenience of the driver, physical address here for the convenience of the adapter. Again, very efficient. You do the translation once and only once. So we called it the N port, N because we were in Napa when we invented it. Q. Okay.
And could you sign your name to it, please? Well, thanks very much. We have time to take some questions from the audience. Did you have a question?
Yes. Catherine, you are well known for your persuasive techniques. Could you share with us some of the tips and tricks you use to get people to agree with your ideas and try to convince them that you are correct?
A lot of it is just persistence, right? Continuing to ask, continuing to deliver, right? I think it's the combination of two. One is being able to persist and continue to ask. The other, and certainly my relationship with Ian, was dependent on the fact that if my team screwed up, we weren't going to get to ask ever again in my life, okay? So I think that's a lot of it, developing a track record and continuing to execute.
Thank you, Catherine, from the Technical Community Network for being our guest today. And thanks to all of you in the audience for coming.